Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of Tech Can't Save Us podcast brought to you by Literal Humans. As always, I am Paul David, one of your co-hosts.
And I'm your other co-host, Maya Darren-Paul-Hornby.
Today, we've got Mickey Pardo, who's a former postdoctoral associate at Colorado State University, now a postdoctoral associate at Cornell University. And we're going to talk about using AI to listen to animals. This is an exciting one. Welcome to the pod, Mickey.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, so as a bit of background, Mickey is currently researching the vocal communication of African savannah elephants. While these sounds are indistinguishable to you or I, Mickey has worked out a way to decode and differentiate the calls via the use of machine learning analysis. Mickey's research has found that elephants can tell if a call was intended for them just by hearing it, which supports the conclusion that elephants address each other with something like a name. This research was published in Nature, Ecology and Evolution, and has now been featured in the New York Times. Before taking up this recent fellowship, Mickey received a PhD from the Department of Neurobiology and Behavior at Cornell University, having completed research concerning the vocal communication and social cognition of acorn woodpeckers in California. We're so excited to have you on the pod, Mickey, to discuss your research and how AI can develop our understanding of animals' communication and behavioral rhythms. Welcome.
Thanks.
Maybe useful just to get, for our audience, just to give a brief definition of bioacoustics. It might not be a term that they heard, just as like a framing definition point. So if you can give that to us.
Sure. So bioacoustics is basically the study of sounds made by living organisms. Usually that means animals, though it doesn't always have to be. And it can be anything from trying to understand how animals communicate with each other, which is what I was doing with this study with African elephants. Or it could be more applied. So, for example, what I'm working on right now actually is trying to use bioacoustics and AI to monitor bird populations. Just by listening to the sounds that animals make, we can learn something about their conservation status and help protect them as well. So it just spans the whole range of anything that has to do with studying the sound made by the living world.
Just another frame question, sort of this idea of you know, machine learning, ML, it's fairly recent, its foray into academia. So we'd love for you to outline how ML is being used in bioacoustics and maybe more widely in neurobiology and behavioral psychology fields as well.
It can be used in so many different ways. So for example, one application of machine learning is often classifying things into categories, which when you're studying animal communication is a very useful tool to have, because often when we're studying the vocalizations that animals make, we want to understand how these vocalizations relate to different meanings. And to do that, we often need to categorize them into classes. So for example, with the elephant study, one thing that I used machine learning for was to try to see if we could classify the calls that elephants make according to the identity of the recipient of the call. So if the calls have names, then there should be something in the sound structure of the call that allows you to figure out who that call was addressed to. So we used a machine learning model, random forest specifically, to try to classify calls according to who the receiver was. And in my current work with birds, we're using a type of machine learning called, it's a deep neural network. It's called BirdNet. And it's basically a machine learning model that's been trained on a vast corpus of recordings of bird vocalizations, and it can identify most of the birds in North America. I think it can identify over 3,000 species of birds. And so we're able to get massive amounts of audio data. I collected like 40,000 hours of audio data in California of birds. And then we can run it through this machine learning model, and it can tell us which species are present much faster than it would be able to if we had been, you know, trying to do this by hand. It would take forever. So it can be really useful in processing large amounts of data. In the case of birds, it can also be useful in finding patterns in the data that the human eye or ear wouldn't be able to detect, as in the case with the elephants.
Yeah. Wow. You reminded me of one of my, I don't know if you've listened to it. I hope you have, but if you haven't, definitely check it out. But one of my favorite sort of story-driven podcasts is called Forest 404. Have you heard of this? From BBC.
No.
So it's like, I mean, you're going to love this, but it's literally a future, like sort of a dystopian future in which like we've built cities like up into the sky and like obviously polluted the ground and things like that. So there aren't really forests left. So Forest 404 refers to a file 404 of like a forest recording that was recorded back in the day. And so the main character is like a kind of a, I think, part android government bureaucrat that spends their days like cataloging like bird sounds and forest sounds and stuff like that. And it's really, it's a really wild listen. I think it's from BBC Studios, but check it out. Little podcast recommendation there.
Cool. For you. Yeah, that sounds good.
Yeah, yeah. I think you'd love it. So
yeah. You also reminded me of recently I went like birding with a bird walk, and somebody like much more experienced sort of led me through it. And they were showing me the app Merlin, which is so cool. Have you heard of this?
No, I haven't. No.
It's essentially like a Shazam for birds.
Oh, wow.
Where you record your surroundings and it helps you identify birds. And it's very contested within the birding community, was the sense I got, because people wrongly classify birds on it and then it goes into the loop. But yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I love Merlin personally. I started using it recently for birding. And it gets things wrong sometimes. But, you know, you have to like take it with a little bit of a grain of salt, but I don't know, at least in my experience so far, it seems pretty accurate. And it's certainly very helpful for me to learn the calls that birds make, because, you know, you look at something, Merlin's like, oh, that's a Carolina wren. And then you're like, huh, I don't know what that sounds like. And then you go and find the bird that's singing, and you're like, oh, okay. And then you can kind of make this association, and then you learn that call. And the next time you hear yourself, you know it. Or maybe after, you know, if you're me, it probably takes like 10 or 20 times, but eventually, you know, you can learn it yourself. So I think it's, I really like it personally. And BirdNet is a similar idea. It's a different machine learning algorithm, but it's the same idea. It basically identifies birds from bird species from their songs and calls. And again, you know, you do need some human verification to make sure that the predictions are accurate. But what we do is we have a trained expert verify a portion of the calls, then we're able to, and BirdNet kind of gives you this score of like how confident it is in a prediction. And so you can say like all the predictions that had a score over a certain amount, they were verified by a trained expert. So we're going to say anything above this cutoff score, we'll be confident that that's an actual detection of the bird in question. So, you know, I think like with any kind of AI, you do need some kind of ground truthing, but it allows you to just process things so much faster than you could if you had to have a trained expert listen to every single call.
Yeah, fascinating. I would love to hear more about your sort of research process with the African savanna elephants. So from sort of becoming interested in the field to writing up your results, could you just outline that process and maybe also talk about how you ensured that it was as non-invasive as possible?
Sure. So I actually first came up with the idea for this study in, I think, 2012, when I was in my first semester of grad school. And I read a PhD thesis by Stephanie King, who's a researcher in the UK. And she had discovered that dolphins could address one another effectively by name by copying the signature whistle of the individual they were trying to address. And I was really fascinated by that. And it made me wonder if elephants could do something similar, because we know that dolphins and elephants are among the few mammals that are capable of learning to imitate sounds. So if dolphins are using their remarkable imitative ability to call one another by name by imitating their signature whistles, that made me wonder if maybe elephants are using their remarkable imitative ability for something similar. So I wasn't able to pursue the idea in grad school, but I kind of held on to it. And then when I finished my PhD, I applied for a postdoc fellowship from the National Science Foundation, and I wrote a grant proposal around this idea, and it got funded. So then I was able to go to Colorado State University and work with George Wittemeyer, my former postdoc supervisor, to kind of try to bring this idea to fruition. So there were sort of two pieces of the study. One was to record as many calls as we could from wild elephants, where we knew not only who made the call, but also who they were addressing. And we figured that out based on the behavioral context. So like, for example, if they were close distance calls, where, you know, two elephants approach one another, one of them vocalizes, it's pretty obvious that they were talking to the elephant they just approached. But in terms of long distance contact calls where the caller and the receiver are out of sight, we would have to use more subtle means of figuring it out. So for example, if one elephant was lagging behind the rest of the group, everybody else was with the group, and there was just one member who was lagging behind, and then somebody with the main body of the group made a long distance contact call, we could be reasonably confident that she was calling to that one individual who was lagging behind. But if the group had kind of split in two and there were two halves, and somebody in one half made a long distance contact call to the other half, and we couldn't see who responded to it because they were too far away, then we just weren't able to use that call. So it was difficult to get calls where we knew who the receiver was, but eventually we were able to get several hundred of these calls. And then I used a type of machine learning model called a random forest to try to predict who the receiver of each call was based on the sound properties of that call, with the idea being that if the calls contain something like a name, then you should be able to predict from the sound patterns in that call who the call was addressed to. So that was the first piece. And then the second piece was to play the calls back to the elephants and see whether they would react more strongly to a call that was originally addressed to them versus to a call from the same caller that was originally addressed to someone else. And we found the elephants could tell just by hearing a call whether it was addressed to themselves or whether it was addressed to another member of the family. And they would react more strongly to a call that was originally addressed to them. So that was sort of the clinching piece that really convinced me that, yeah, these calls do have something like a name embedded within them.
Wow.
And in terms of my understanding of your research is that it shows something a little bit different to how the naming process works in dolphins and also parrots. Would you be able to sort of explain that in layman's terms?
You know, at least based on what we currently have. So with dolphins and parrots, they can address one another by imitating the signature call of the individual they're trying to address. Now, elephants, at least based on what we know about them currently, there's no evidence that they have signature calls. That at least we can't identify a call that's very obviously like this is the calling sign of this individual and each individual has their own. Instead, elephant calls are specific to the caller, but it seems that it's just like every caller has a unique voice, which is different than having a signature call that you produce to identify yourself. So if elephants are imitating one another to address each other, they're probably doing it by imitating the voice patterns of the individual they're trying to address. So we tried to assess whether that was the case by comparing calls that were addressed to a given individual to the calls made by that receiver. And we found that calls were no more similar to the calls made by the receiver than to the calls made by other elephants. So that suggests, at least based on our current data set, that elephants are not imitating one another to address each other. And I say based on our current data set because it's possible we just didn't have enough recordings of each individual, and maybe they're imitating calls that we just didn't record. But from what we can tell currently, there's no evidence that they're imitating each other to address one another. And that's really interesting because it's different than how naming works in dolphins and parrots. And if future research substantiates this, it would suggest that elephants are naming each other using sounds that are completely arbitrary and unrelated to the sounds made by the individual that they refer to, which would be exciting because that's actually one of the key features of human language, the ability to refer to things with completely arbitrary sounds that have no inherent connection to the thing they refer to is what allows us to communicate about such a wide range of things. Like if we could only communicate iconically, like obviously sign language is mostly iconic. Most gestures in sign language have some connection to the thing they refer to, but that's because it's in the visual modality. If you're communicating in the spoken modality, then having arbitrary signals is really important. So if it turns out that elephants also have arbitrary names, it gives us kind of a second point of reference to try to understand the evolution of arbitrary signaling. And it also tells us something about elephants' abilities as on their own. Like it tells us something about their cognitive abilities that they can understand this abstract connection between a sound that has nothing to do with the thing it refers to and this other individual, like, you know, just this random sound. And then they understand the connection between that sound and the individual that they're using that sound to name.
That's interesting.
Your research has been featured in the New York Times, as I said. Why do you think there has been such public interest in this and, you know, such appetite for a story about elephants or just sort of a more human-like communication in animals?
That's a good question. I think humans are kind of egocentric by nature, and I think that we are automatically drawn to characteristics in other animals that remind us of ourselves. So I think that part of it is that names are something that we're very familiar with. We use them every day. We feel like some kind of, you know, emotional attachment to our own names, and they're very important to us culturally. And so I think hearing about that in another species makes us identify with that species more than hearing about, you know, perhaps some other ability. And then I think the other thing is that elephants themselves are a very charismatic animal, and people already really like elephants. So the fact that it's elephants plus names, I think is probably why people are so interested in it. Which is maybe not fair to a lot of the other research that's done, which is just as fascinating, but maybe with a species that isn't quite as charismatic. I mean, I'm not complaining. Obviously, I find elephants charismatic, right? That's why I'm so interested in them in the first place.
Yeah. But like, yeah, your research on woodpeckers didn't get featured in the New York Times. No. So maybe that's proof in the pudding.
No. Well, we can stay on the topic of elephants, even if loosely. You were researching at a site in northern Kenya. That's a country that's near and dear to my heart. I studied in Nairobi in uni, so love me some Kenya. And that work was monitored by a postdoctoral supervisor and the nonprofit conservation organization Save the Elephants. We work with a lot of universities. We work with a lot of nonprofits. Just curious to hear about your experience working with a nonprofit like Save the Elephants in a research capacity. And how you kind of to the last question, how you hope people interact with the research as it rolls out.
I really, really liked my time in Kenya working with Save the Elephants. And Save the Elephants is kind of they're not the only organization like this, but they are a little bit unusual in the NGO world in terms of how much they focus on research. So being able to work in this environment where the people that I was living with in the research camp, you know, some of them were focused mostly on applied conservation or even like policy, like a lot of people at Save the Elephants are involved in dealing with conservation policy at kind of a higher level, but there are also people who are kind of doing research with elephants directly on a day-to-day basis. So I kind of got to see a little bit of both of those. Obviously, I was more involved in the research side, but what was great about working with Save the Elephants is that because they are maintaining this project that George Whittemeyer started originally, and continues to supervise, because they're doing this long-term monitoring project of the elephants. Some of the staff members of Save the Elephants who work on this long-term monitoring project every day, they have an incredible knowledge of all of the elephants in the population. They can identify all of these elephants by sight. And so I was able to benefit from their knowledge. Specifically, my co-author, David Lochiragi, was the one that I worked with the most. And so he was able to teach me how to identify all the elephants. And I couldn't have done this research if I couldn't tell the elephants apart. If I had had to figure that out on my own, I don't think I would have been able to do this project, because it would have just taken so much time to build up that database of individual identities of all these elephants. And because that was already in place and maintained by Save the Elephants, that's kind of what allowed me to do this sort of more specific type of study where I was able to test these hypotheses.
Do you see any immediate implications or I should say applications for your research for the work that, say, the elephant's doing or the work that other folks doing, you know, elephant conservation are doing?
Yeah, I think one of the main applications of this kind of work is sort of in the realm of changing hearts and minds, right? So Save the Elephants does a lot of educational work in addition to their scientific work. So they understand the importance of like educating younger generations about wildlife and about elephants in particular. And I think that because my research is, it captures people's imagination, like elephants having names is something that people really identify with and they're excited by. My hope, at least, is that this could help improve tolerance for elephants in elephant range states and also hopefully help raise money for elephant conservation in the Western world. By kind of teaching people about elephants, exciting them about elephants, getting them to identify with elephants more, that might sort of translate to tangible benefits for elephant conservation.
Yeah, and that sort of perfectly leads me on to the next question, which is essentially just that on a wider scale, like you're a keen animal rights advocate and conservationist. How do you believe that AI can best be harnessed by activists in order to promote these sorts of causes and perhaps appeal to what you said earlier is sort of humans' egocentrism?
Well, that's a tough question. So I think that AI, like any other tool, it can be used for good purposes, bad purposes, or neutral purposes. And I think really the issue at stake is what the purpose is, right? Like it's a tool like any other. And so I think in conservation, AI can be really, really valuable because it allows us to process much larger data sets than we would ever be able to process otherwise. So that in and of itself is hugely helpful. And another way that it can be helpful is by allowing us to sample wild animal populations in a more non-invasive way. So like, for example, by using bioacoustics, we can just stick recorders out in the forest or in whatever environment we're trying to sample, record the sound the animals make, and then process it with AI rather than having to actually send out human observers into the environment to actually see the animals or hear them themselves, which can disturb the animals. So I think AI has potential to be used for more non-invasive monitoring of wildlife populations. But I think there's probably so many other applications that I'm not even thinking of because I'm not a computer scientist. You know, I'm sure that the possibilities are probably almost infinite.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, in terms of one in bioacoustics, I mean, you're probably much more familiar with it than I am. But I saw, while researching for this episode, a project called Guacamayo, led by Microsoft in partnership with the Humboldt Institute, which essentially is capturing sounds from the Amazon in Colombia and applying an AI model to differentiate between bird and non-bird sounds, which helps researchers identify more than about 2,000 bird species with over 80% reliability, which essentially can then make more legible and give us more data about problems caused by mining and deforestation.
Exactly. Yeah. So that kind of project where you're combining AI with bioacoustics allows you to process much larger bioacoustic data sets than you would be able to otherwise. And then you can assess, I mean, the first step for any kind of conservation is to figure out what the problem is, right? Figure out which areas are most biodiverse, which areas are under threat, where biodiversity is declining, and why. And then once you know the where and the why, you can start and figure out the how of how do you solve this problem. But first we need to collect that data, and without the power of bioacoustics and AI, it can end up being a much more expensive and complicated task. But AI allows us to deal with these massive data sets, so it no longer becomes a bottleneck, like trying to process all the data once you have AI models that can do it for you.
I'd be quite interested to hear about what were the sort of old school, more analog methods before AI came and enabled researchers to process loads of data. Like, I presume that 2012 dolphin study wasn't using machine learning analysis to the same degree that yours did, at least.
Not that I recall. Dolphins kind of have one unique advantage over elephants in that their signature whistles or their names are very easily discernible to humans. So you can actually, a lot of dolphin researchers will actually just use humans to manually sort through spectrograms and classify dolphin whistles into categories. And it turns out they can actually perform quite well. You can never do that with elephants. So in terms of like how people would process bioacoustic data before AI models that could do it, it just really limited the scope of bioacoustic data you could collect, because you would have to have a person go through the spectrograms. Like let's say you wanted to monitor birds with acoustic recorders before AI models like BirdNet that could do it for you. You would go out, you put the recorders in the forest, then you would take them back, and you would have to manually go through the spectrograms or have some poor undergrad do it and find all the bird calls by hand, by just listening to the recording. Or you could try to like write a detection algorithm that would do it for you, but it would be laborious and time consuming, and it would take a long time to train it, and it would be, you know, very species specific. Now with AI, we can run 40,000 hours of audio data through BirdNet, and in a relatively short amount of time, get all of the bird species that it detects in there with pretty good accuracy. So beforehand, we would never have been able to collect that much data because we never would have been able to process it all. So we would have had to sample a much smaller area, and it would have limited the power of our analyses to detect changes in bird communities.
Oh. Really cool. Always like to end on kind of a more personal question, just to give the audience a bit more flavor of sort of who you are and what you're up to. Would love to hear a bit more about what's next for you after this postdoctoral fellowship. Where are you taking your research pursuits and building on the great success of this this initial research you've done?
Yeah, thanks. Right now I'm a postdoc at Cornell. I'm working on trying to develop some skills in using bioacoustics for more applied conservation applications. And I'm working on birds at the moment, but I really want to go back to the elephants and continue working on that study. So I guess what I need is to find a permanent position, like a faculty position somewhere, and get a grant that will allow me to continue this research. In addition to my professional work, I also, as you mentioned, I do a lot of animal rights advocacy. So I'm working on a political campaign right now at home here in Colorado. You know, that's kind of like occupying a bunch of my free time right now.
Well, yeah, I appreciate the work that you're doing in conservation spaces and the massive addition that you've made to, the research space with the work that you've done with both woodpeckers and elephants. And hopefully the work that you do with elephants is a little bit easier to sell and get some people excited. But I hope obviously the work you do with birds picks up pace as well. So great. I think that's
cool.
It.
Cool. Thanks.
Yeah, is there, I guess, with not all sort of research being splashed on the front pages, like, is there any other research going on right now, perhaps, of any sort of other fellows or just other peers that you want to shout out?
So the SETI project is, you've probably heard of them. They're doing some really cool stuff with sperm whales in AI right now. So they recently published a paper showing that sperm whale communication is structured in ways that are more complex than previously thought in terms of how the vocalizations are actually put together, which is really cool. So I'm really excited to kind of see where that ends up and what they're able to discover, because they have a pretty big budget and the ability to use AI with really large data sets that we don't have with the elephants, for example. So we don't have that many calls.
Well, appreciate you allowing us to kind of, this is our first sort of episode dipping our toe into bioacoustics and like the use of AI. And you've given us some good follow-on stuff. Maybe talk to the folks at SETI about the work they're doing with sperm whales. And you've kind of whet our appetite for digging into AI and bioacoustics as it goes forward. So thank you for that
cool.
So much. Yeah, appreciate
Thanks.
It. Thanks, y'all. This has been another great episode of Tech Can't Save Us podcast brought to you by Literal Humans. We've had Mickey Pardo, who's a postdoctoral associate now at Cornell, formerly at Colorado State University, who's done some fantastic research with woodpeckers and elephants specifically. And this episode's been about using AI to listen to animals. So thanks so much for your time again, Mickey.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.
Thanks for having me.